are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 309. And welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in Niagara Falls, Ontario, in my palatial basement where I'm hiding from my family and my dog and the rain and basically like current events and everything else. So I'm just hiding. Joining me on tonight's show, hopefully also in hiding, really, out of Brooklyn, infrequent show guest, but we're always happy to have him back, Mr. Christopher Barrett, Punk News writer, reviewer. How you doing, Chris?
Hanging in. How are we doing over there? Canada today?
We're just fine. It's a little wet. That's a sudden thing. It started to pour rain like 14 minutes ago, and I had to run outside and close my car windows and everything, but we're good. And also,
got some cool air this way. It's a serious heat wave over here in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we've got the same thing, so that this rain is the only thing keeping my front lawn from catching fire.
All right,
so joining me also in tonight's show, finally off a cell phone, finally I want to say back to a place of good physical health, if not good mental health, of a sound constitution, a man resurrected like a phoenix from the ashes, Mr. John Gentile.
Rise from your grave.
How you doing, John?
That's an Altered Beast reference. Adam, do you remember Altered Beast?
I do, and I remember it I don't remember it super well, if only because I was a Nintendo guy and that was a Sega game.
But Altered Beast was cool.
Yeah, I definitely remember, you know, going across the street to the kid that had the Sega and seeing it there, and then going the Sega looks and feels weird to me, and then going back home to my Nintendo world and secretly scoffing him. But I always thought Altered Beast was pretty rad. It's a pretty metal game if you think about it.
It's a real metal game. It's set in ancient Greece. You're a werewolf. You kill zombies. Pretty badass.
So John, this is a big week for you. It is because John, forgive me if I'm wrong here, but you live in the city of brotherly love. Do you not live in the city of Philadelphia?
Oh, I know what you're referencing. I actually technically live right outside the city of brotherly love.
Okay. So you live pretty close to Philadelphia. Now, John, given the revelations with the NSA and everything that they were monitoring, you know, the emails of everybody.
Uh-oh, I'll take time.
Do you think that since that revelation, do you think the U.S. government is still monitoring, you know, online communications and things like that?
Do I think the government's monitoring online communications?
Yeah,
certainly.
Certainly. Do you think they would have a particular interest in monitoring online communications that may be in the same city as the president and the vice president and the Democratic candidate and a whole ton of politicos and stuff like that?
Certainly.
Because, I mean, you got to look out for all the crazies and the weirdos and everything, right?
Yeah, certainly.
So, John,
you never know what could happen.
That means there is a pretty good chance that this podcast could be you, could be Mr. Christopher Barrett, could be me, and it could be like a bunch of spooks.
It could be. They could be listening to get the latest punk rock news and see what's going on with the subversive crew.
They might, right? So we very well may have an audience, particularly because of your physical proximity to all of these important world leaders and, you know, movers and shakers right now. John, do you think it would be jumping the gun if I don't know, the someone from the CIA or the FBI or I don't know, the ATF or whoever were to bust down the front door of your house and like put a boot on your neck and put a nuzzle of a gun in your mouth and just to, you know, put the fear of God in you that you're not going to do anything?
Your question is, do I think that's likely?
Well, do you think it's you know, would you, if it were to happen, and I'm not saying that it should happen, but to anyone listening, if it were to happen, Would you ultimately say, you know what, it was probably for the greater good of the country?
If it would happen, I think I'd say it was a Canadian that put me up to it, named Adam White. he lives up near Niagara Falls. He's about 5'8".
I'm harmless. I'm not even within the borders, John. You're within, I don't want to say striking distance, but John, you're pretty close.
You know, Adam, there's open wounds in America right now, and you Canadians are doing the best to rub salt in the wounds. How quickly you forget that not too long ago you had a mayor that was smoking crack. and so I'm just going to say that what goes around comes around. So I'll remember this next time Canada's got a soft spot. I'll just dig in. So enjoy your cup of Schadenfreude now, Adam White. Drink deeply from it, because I will be taking that same gulp in a few years.
What I would like you to do throughout this podcast is, if you are near a window, first of all, I would say maybe get away from the window. But if you are near a window, if you could sneak a peek, and if you see any vans, or I don't know, like black helicopters, or I don't know how they're going to get you, John, but they've got their methods, like they're professionals.
Well,
we need a plausibility scale of this happening. Well, so do we have a plausibility scale?
73
that we can do.
Well, listen, if I can quote World Inferno Friendship Society, there's a famous quote that I'm not going to say in case anybody's listening, but you all know that famous quote if you know World Inferno Friendship Society. And it ends with the phrase, "And I'll do it again and again and again and again."
John, I'm looking at the CNN website right now, and it looks like Bloomberg is currently on stage doing his spiel, which means Biden's done, and I don't know, is Obama after him? I don't know.
I think he's last, yeah.
Oh, you know. That's funny.
Oh, uh-oh. We got an operator. Yeah,
listen, guys, we have to be done the podcast by 10:15 tonight. No reason.
All right, well, if anyone busts down your door and takes you down during this show, I will have done my job for society. So, what's in the mail, John?
What's in the mail is Adam White trying to set me up for a fall. I won't forget this, Canada. I won't forget this at all. Listen, you can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We got a couple of letters here. Our first letter is from our friend Rich up there in the UK. And Rich, who used to run a record label in the 80s, and they put out a couple of records. This is what Richard says. My God, guys, you weren't kidding on that Good Charlotte video. My dog, when I was growing up, was called Charlotte. I feel like they have desecrated her memory. Now I'm off to see Lagwagon to cleanse my soul. And that's from Richard out there in the UK. We love getting Richard's mail. This next one is from Drone Clone, who I'm mad at.
Uh-oh, here we go.
I'm mad at
Hot take time.
I'm mad at a lot of people this week, but I'm particularly mad at Drone Clone, because Drone Clone used to be one of these guys who used to ride my back all the time. I'm like, this guy's a dick. And then he kind of stopped doing it. So, I mean, I didn't really dig in. I never attack anybody first, ever. And so Drone Clone kind of started being a normal, regular guy, so that I treated him that way. And he sent in a pretty good question that I was planning on reading today. But then after it, he started to become one of these, "Oh, John's an asshole, John's a dumbass, I hate John" kind of guys. So, I mean, I'm definitely not you're in either with us or against us kind of guy. I'm not that kind of mentality. But listen, either you want to be an asshole and treat me like an asshole, then I'll treat you like an asshole. Either you're going to be that, or you're going to be a person that treats someone else with respect. You don't have to like what I write. You can criticize what I write, but you have to have a common sense of human decency. So either you're going to be one of those guys that's an asshole and I'll treat you like an asshole, or you're going to be a person that is capable of critical thought in a actual conversation. You can't be. I'm so sick of punk rock. These people that, you know, are nice to your face, but then they say nasty things around town because it's very cowardly, and it's in all segments of society, but in particularly in punk rock, there's a distinct lack of loyalty, or even of loyalty, of lack of respect, where people just say whatever they feel like, and that you really can't trust anything anybody says, and you can't like even believe anything anybody says, because the minute they wander away, they start snapping on you and you know, just saying bullshit. So listen, Drone Clone, I think you're an all right guy. I'm not sure, but if you're going to be an asshole, then I'll treat you like an asshole. But if you want to be a decent human being, then I'll treat you that way. So you got to pick. So I was going to read this letter, then I wasn't going to read this letter, but now I'll read the letter, and we'll see how he reacts in the future, because he had a good letter. If you recall, on a couple of podcasts ago, I said that I thought Henry Rollins was being kind of a dick with the jeans ad, because he used to talk about, he would talk about how he thinks Flag is old men doing old music and how he has no respect for that. But then he went ahead and did a jeans ad, you know, for jeans made in sweatshops. And the ad prominently featured the Black Flag logo, which I thought was quite hypocritical. Henry Rollins was being all high and mighty, saying, "Oh, I won't play old music," but then he's, you know, selling the Black Flag logo to sell jeans, which I think is crazy. I also said during that podcast that I think there's a distinct passive aggressive vibe that you see in Washington D.C. in the Midwest, and I pointed out Ian MacKaye, and I think Ian MacKaye does that a lot. And I also said, how come Andrew Jackson, how come AJJ can't use the word jihad, but they can make fun of the Bible all they want? So anyway, Drone Clone had a couple of thoughts on that. He said, "John, what were you referring to when you kept bringing up Ian? If you're a shitty person, you can't be in the business for as long as Ian has without that stuff getting around. I've never really heard much negative about those guys. 90% of the bad stuff I've heard had nothing to do with the band or the people themselves, but just ignorant and unfair projections people put on the band. Anybody that can't see them just as people that makes mistakes like any of us do, that's their problem. Fugazi did more with what they were given than just about any other band that I can think of. When it comes to Henry Rollins, as much as I like and respect him, I've never looked at him the same way as I do with Fugazi or Godspeed You Black Emperor in their approach to business practices. Calvin Klein sucks, and I can't blame you for losing respect for him for doing it, but he's done shitty advertisements before, and he has been in silly TV shows and movies. He's never put himself on any kind of a pedestal in regards to that kind of stuff that you seem to be putting him on. That quote you lifted didn't really seem as bad as you were making it, and you calling him hypocritical because he did that the West Memphis 3 benefit doesn't hold any water. He did that benefit totally different. He did that for a benefit, which is totally different. I love Flag too, but I can't blame anybody for not wanting to rehash the songs that were written 30 years ago. Also, I take offense to the slight aimed at DC in the Midwest. A completely silly generalization and objectively false. Totally agree with you about Andrew Jackson Jihad. So I'll respond to those different things. With Ian MacKaye, I specifically see quite a bit of passive aggressiveness come from Ian MacKaye. I'm not saying Ian MacKaye's a terrible guy, but I'm saying there is a distinct passive aggressive vibe in it. And Ian MacKaye always seems to, you know, says, I'll say the truth no matter what, you know, what, no matter what it is, I'll give you the truth. And I think Ian MacKaye uses that to passively aggressive rag on his friends, and he has a distinct lack of loyalty. I could be wrong, but here's just one example. There's a video you can find on YouTube where it's Ian MacKaye and Glenn Friedman looking at Glenn Friedman's new book. And it's an advertisement for Glenn Friedman's book, basically. And Glenn Friedman's like, look at all my neat books. You know, look at all these cool pictures I did. Here's one of Run DMC. Here's one of the Beastie Boys. Here's one of Black Flag. And Ian MacKaye says, well, these aren't all the pictures you took, are they? And he's like, well, no, these are the ones that I think are the best. He's like, well, you should have put all of them in. And so it just goes to show how passive-aggressive Ian MacKaye, and this is just one instance. If you want me to dig up a bunch of instances, I can. But Glenn E. Friedman is very proud of his book, and he's excited that his book is out, and he's excited for people to check out his book. And in the advertisement for the book, Ian MacKaye starts pointing out flaws that he perceives in the book, subjective flaws. I mean, if you want to support your friend in something your friend's proud of doing, do you point out what you think are the flaws in front of the whole like the whole world, or do you say that privately, or do you keep your tongue shut? You know, keep your mouth shut. So Ian MacKaye, I think he's like, well, I always say the truth. Well, you know what? Sometimes always saying the truth is very disrespectful towards your friends and is an ugly side. You know, I mean, you don't always need to tell the entire truth or the truth all the time. I'm not talking about like important things, but your opinion of your friend's art, you don't need to point out the flaws in it. And so you should Google that video. And Ian MacKaye does it a lot. Another example is that there's that famous story of Henry Rollins, Ian MacKaye putting rat poison at Baskin Robbins, like up by the toppings. And, you know, Henry Rollins' story, which I believe is drastically different than Ian MacKaye's story. Henry Rollins' stories, they had it up there for hours and they would laugh as people would go by and they're like, oh, you don't want that. But Ian MacKaye's story, if you watch the Nardwar interview with him, he's like, oh, we only had it up there for 30 seconds, but then no one came near it, which doesn't seem to be true. So Ian MacKaye seems to purposely be crafting an image for himself that isn't exactly true. And I'm not saying he's not a good guy and I'm not saying he's not a legendary musician. He is. But I do think there's a certain strain of passive aggressiveness in him and a certain crafting of his image, which I don't like. With regards to Henry Rollins, you mentioned that I'm blowing the comment out of proportion. I don't think I am. There's actually another interview that I'll see if I can pull up when this runs, where Henry really digs in the Flag and basically says, well, it was okay for us to do it because we were doing it for a benefit. They're not doing it for a benefit. But Henry Rollins, again, is coming from this high and mighty perspective in that Henry Rollins has got a lot more money than Keith Morse. Henry Rollins has got a lot more money than Dez Kadena. So Henry Rollins can afford to do a benefit. Keith Morse, I don't think, can afford to do a benefit. So isn't Keith Morse entitled to make some money off some of the most important punk rock that he had a very important hand in crafting? And meanwhile, Henry Rollins is kind of pissing on that. Again, same exact thing as Ian MacKaye. You know, Keith Morse always says Henry Rollins is his friend. Dez Kadena says he respects Henry Rollins. And so if your friends are doing something that maybe you don't think is the greatest, wouldn't you just keep your mouth shut and not say anything or kind of dodge the question? But instead of supporting his friends or being quiet if he really doesn't want to, you know, not tell the truth, then wouldn't you just be quiet? But no, Henry Rollins has to go in and get that dig right into his friends and then turn around and use the black flag bars and sell jeans. So I think that's hypocritical and I think it's lame and I lost respect for Henry Rollins for doing that. I don't buy the fact that because Henry Rollins was a benefit and Keith Morris isn't a benefit makes it that much different. I think it's exactly the same. I don't buy the fact that, oh, well, if it's a benefit, you can do whatever you want. I don't buy that. And I think that answers all the questions, and that's my opinion. So the ball's in your court, Drone Clone. I think you're an all right guy, but I didn't appreciate you writing nasty stuff about me after you earnestly asked a question. So you can either be cool or not be cool. It's up to you. And that goes to anybody out there. I mean, I never attack anybody first, but if you're going to attack me, I'm going to attack you back. You know, it's punknews.org. It's not the New York Times. You know, if you don't like it, F you. That's punk rock, you know? So anyway, that's my opinion.
Now, John, you mentioned Drone Clone, right?
Yeah. He's been around a long time.
You know what else has been around a long time, John? Since about 1994 is the RQ-1 MQ-1 Predator drone. Now, if you look out your window, do you see any lights or anything that falls under the Predator drone general shadow profile or what have you?
Not yet, Adam, but I'll be sure to let you know.
Adam, I'm actually insulted that you're asking that, and the reason why I'm insulted is that you really think that you know the people in Philadelphia with the DNC are going to use a drone that's been around for 20 years. It's time to, you know, spin a new bad boy out, you know, something they spent, $3 billion on. Maybe, you know, developed it in the last 3 years. Give it a little test run now, see how it goes.
Oh, so you're saying when John goes, it's going to be some fucking stealth drone that we don't even know exists.
Oh, yeah. Come on. You're not going to use old technology. You got to get with the program. It's 2016.
Well, at least I'll go out with a bang.
Well, actually, I think there's the new technology prevents the bang and prefers more like when the Olympic divers don't leave a splash, something like that.
What if it's one of those like those little drones that's like the size of like a dragonfly?
Yeah, something like that. It's gonna crawl in on the back of a water bug.
Shit.
So,
well, all right, John, we're on borrowed time. Do you have any more news or any more mailbag stuff?
No, you can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. Who knows if I'll be here next week or not? We'll find out.
Oh, boy. That was the mail. We got a whole bunch of stories to talk about this week. Lots of cool stuff happened. John, do you want to play us a song before we get going, or should we get going?
Sure. I'll play a song. Let me think. What song? I know. I'm just going to play. I'm not going to mention what song this is, but we'll just play it and we'll see what happens.
Just give me a second, I'll go. And women who are from the mothers don't be sitting around at home. I'll call for the kitchen name for you, boy. What is my will? I've lost everyone in your animal I've ever known. And this got me every damn situation. I hope so. I'm gonna cop to the door. Something I've been doing, I both know. Don't leave you off, but I'm out the window. This is all alone.
Goddamn mess.
And that was some song by John Gentile. I don't know what it was. So we're going to get into some of the stories that happened this past week and talk about some of the things that happened. There was a lot of cool media that came online. There was quite a few things for you to go listen to, for you to go check out. Among them, a bunch of the big punk rock records are now streaming, are now available for you to go preview. The one of them, of course, the Bouncing Souls new record is now online to check out, so you can go stream that entire thing. The other is the much anticipated new Descendants album, Hypercaphenum Spazinate. The full record is set to come out, was it this week?
This Friday,
it's coming out via Epitaph Records, but you can find a whole stream of it over at NPR, unless you live in Canada, which
yes,
is me.
So yes,
I haven't heard yes. shit. So, yeah, I might not be, you know, executed by an unfeeling robot tonight, but, you know, I didn't get to hear this Descendants record early, so woe is me. But, John, have you heard this?
I have.
What do you think?
I think it's real good. I think it's a combination of mid-80s and mid-90s Descendants. Not a whole lot of the Milo Goes to College vibe on it, but some really punky numbers, which are always my favorite Descendant numbers. Some more pop-punk numbers. I like the punky numbers the best, like the song about food, which is really good. The song about Milo quitting his job is really good. And I think this is exactly what the Descendants fans want. It's definitely not a radical change, but it is what a lot of bands do later in their career, which is a wise move. Is it's a resharpening of things they've already done into a tight package. I think it's well done.
Yeah, I would say I didn't give it quite the listen that John gave. But I'll say the same thing in terms of if I'm looking at it correctly, it's about 30 minutes in length for 16 songs, and I believe. So if you ask for my personal opinion, my two favorite Descendant albums are Milo Goes to College and Everything Sucks. So, you know, say what you want, can have a debate about that, whatever. It's a good, like John said, kind of sharpening, but also it kind of blends it together. You know, they're all older now, so you can't exactly write about the exact same things you wrote about in 1982 or even 1996. Now it's 20 years ago. So it kind of, you know, the subject matter is good. It's kind of, you know, relevant and contemporary. There was a song, Limiter, that I found interesting where they kind of touch on medication and kids. And I guess as a teacher who works with students with disabilities, it's an interesting topic that a lot of people seem to get in debate about. So it was a little simplified in a song like that. It was interesting to hear that perspective, but that was a song that stood out for me. But for the songs themselves, I'm so glad they got away from what they did with Cool to Be You. And, you know, they try to write, you know, older songs. I don't want to say older songs, meaning like songs from their older catalog, but just where they are in life. Those songs were a little too long. They dragged on maybe an extra minute or two for each song. There's some songs that were like a minute or less that was good to see. So it's a good length, you know, good subject matter. You know, definitely it's got to grow a little bit more. It's got to fester a little bit more because I only listened to it a little bit. But definitely, you know, something to worth checking out, especially if you are questioning why the Descendants are coming back after what's this like 12 years since School of the Bayou came out. Yeah.
Hey, Chris, can we mention the specific area that you teach in, of school that you teach in?
Yeah, I teach emotionally disturbed students. So in other words, I for the past 2 years I taught eighth grade, and emotionally disturbed students are students that are considered, you know, if you talk to them, high functioning, seem like regular students, but generally have behavioral issues that have gotten them suspended or expelled from other schools. So they have to do a lot before they even show up to my classroom. Often, you know, I could get in a whole special education policy, but I don't want to be here all day talking about that. But some kids that I do work with do take medication. And if, for my personal opinion, I'm not one who generally loves to push that. But for some kids, it kind of helps calm their extreme urges and moods. And then for other kids, it doesn't help. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. It's a really complicated subject. So it was interesting that they touched on it. But it's a really, really complicated subject about, you know, kids and medication and how they function every day.
Well, there you have it. Adam, I don't know if you had a comment on the album or anything.
No. I mean, I haven't been able to hear the damn thing yet because NPR is trying to impress me. So
is Meteor Fire blocked by Justin Trudeau up there, or
I don't partake in the darker sections of the Silk Road there, Chris. Uh-oh. You know, stay out of those places. Don't want to.
I could find someone who's delivering some goods. Maybe I could sneak, I don't know, a CD or something. You know, maybe you could throw some sound waves over your way.
No, you know what? Like, I mean, the best way to do it would be if you could just like burn it to a CD and attach it to, say, like a tiny model train and just shoot it over the border. Then
yeah, we could do that.
That's how we get things here in Canada. Did anyone listen to? I wasn't in the show notes, so I forgive this if I'm jumping this on anyone. Did anyone listen to the Bouncing Souls record? The stream of that.
Ooh, I'm not gonna lie. I am a Bouncing Souls fan, and I've been on another planet recently, and I have not listened to it. No, Sam, my wife who contributes here as well, has listened to it and has enjoyed it. So I will say she is a big Souls fan. You know, we were lukewarm to the last record. She said it's definitely an improvement. So that's all I could say on that. I haven't personally listened to it.
Yeah, I'd spun it just kind of sort of in the background while I was doing some things at work, and it's not bad. It's definitely, I think, an improvement over the last one. There are, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot on there that is quite fun and engaging, and I'm really looking forward to actually going and engaging more with that whole record. So yeah, that also is coming out this week. I don't want to get completely overshadowed by this Descendants release or anything like that. But
absolutely.
But John, let's jump back in time a little bit.
We should mention Sam Barrett, Chris's wife. She did an excellent interview with the Bouncing Souls, which you can check out at Punk News.
Oh shit, yeah. It's a really good interview, and yes. we'll link it.
Please read that.
We'll link it up in the notes that go up with this. So you should go check that out too.
Well, anyway, look, Adam White was saying jumping back in time. Viv Albertine, one of the main slits, one of the three main slits. She recently visited the British Library Punk 1976 to 1978 exhibit. But when she got there, she saw on the wall a big wall-size short history of punk rock. It mentioned the Sex Pistols, the Clash, and the Buzzcocks. Didn't really mention any other bands, and it didn't mention any of the female bands or bands with female persons in them. So what did Viv Albertine do? Being the subversive person that she is, she broke out her pen and right there on the Queen's Royal Exhibit wrote her own revised history of it, which X'd out the Sex Pistols and the Clash and wrote in the Slits, the X-Ray Specs, and Susie Sue and the Banshees, which I think is a lovely and wonderful and fitting thing for Viv Albertine to do. Surprisingly, a lot of opinions on this. I thought it was pretty cool that she did that, and I do think the omission of the Slits, the X-Ray Specs, Susie Sue, and a couple of the other bands was kind of a faux pas with regard to the punk history. Although, I mean, record sales-wise, Pistols and Clash and Buzzcocks sold much more. But that being said, it would have been nice to include them because particularly, you know, the Slits and X-Ray Specs had a very different sound than any of those bands. So I think they should have included them because they were first-wave punk bands as well. So I thought this was funny. Some people were like hating on this and say, well, you know, she's just mad because she's not as popular as The Clash. I don't think that's true, because if The Clash were all women, I don't think Viv Albertine would sneak in and write on the slits. You know what I mean? Chris Barrett, what's your perspective on it? Is this cool? Is it funny? Or is this Viv Albertine just being jealous?
I don't think it's necessarily a jealousy thing, because I could see other bands who were involved in the movement at that time doing something like that. And it's not like it's someone who happens to like the Slits who, you know, wrote on it. It's someone who was involved at the time or around the time that's directly writing on the exhibit. And I could see where people are like, you know, is that really necessary? You know, those who really care will know anyway. And then at the same time, I feel like, I guess a good example is that me and my wife went to the CBGB restaurant in Newark Airport in New Jersey. And it just seems that anytime punk is mentioned, the same few, you know, to the mainstream, the same few bands are mentioned. And I actually do appreciate the subversiveness, because maybe someone who is kind of, you know, new to it, or, you know, young and trying to figure it out, hasn't heard of these bands and maybe wants to go check it out and see what they've contributed. So I don't mind it, you know, but I mean, I could see where it's like, you know, not necessary, but for the most part, I don't mind it. I think it's cool.
This Adam, I have a couple of things that pop into my head about this. The one is that I think what she did is sort of wonderful. If for no other reason than, you know, it's a big punk rock exhibit in a very official place, and I'm okay with, especially people that were there and part of that original scene, going in and, you know, and tweaking it a little bit. She didn't go and, you know, she didn't destroy anything per se. She didn't, you know, burn 5 million pounds worth of memorabilia what's his dick there, but the
son of Malcolm McLaren's son, but that's not his name,
the lingerie maker guy. You know, she's not doing something like that as a giant call for attention. She didn't even post that she did this. Someone posted that she did this, and I think that it fits very much with the whole, I don't know, the whole spirit of that era, is that it's, you know, it's, so there's a little bit of kill your idols, you know, notion. I don't mean the band, I mean the, you know, the idea of killing your idols, like that. Yeah. You know, that's into there. You can still absolutely read what's on there, but there's, you know, now there's a little bit more, and there's a little bit of rebellion worked into it. I like that. That's fun. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I could understand if you had to take everything that happened in punk rock and make it into, like, I don't know, something that you could fit on a business card, then yeah, you're probably going to mention the Sex Pistols and the Clash. And I mean, if you're talking about the US and the Ramones and Black Flag and all that, but like, if like, this is an exhibit that they designed, so clearly the amount of information that they are relaying about punk rock was not enough to fully encompass what was going on there, or at least to maybe adequately encompass what was going on there. So whoever curated this probably could have given this a couple more passes and, you know, maybe included a little bit more of the scene that was going on there. I mean, to say the Sex Pistols, the Clash, and the Buzzcocks is so fucking obvious. And it doesn't take, you don't need to be a punk rock historian to realize that there was, you know, let's say a handful of 8 to 10 other bands that you might want to mention if you're trying to encompass that whole scene, and not just the ones that had, you know, major label deals and things like that. But you know, I see no harm on Viv from Viv Albertine here. You know, all the power to her. That's what I say.
Fair enough. And speaking of other powerful women in punk rock, this one's a ripper, man. Screaming Females, which is not just a woman, it's one woman and two guys. And actually, maybe it's even rude of me to say, maybe mention gender at all. I don't know if gender, well, I mean, there's a gender in the band's name. I don't know. Anyways, and we got three guys arguing over it. But listen, Screaming Females are a great band. They released a track called Skeleton. Skeleton is a B-side. Actually, I think Adam White might actually have it on his rare Screaming Female 7-inch that came with their last album, Rose Mountain. Well, the band's going on tour in Australia, and they're going to release a deluxe edition tour only of Rose Mountain in Australia with lots of bonus tracks. And man, I won a copy. This track was ripping. The band stated that the reason they didn't include this on the album per se is because it didn't really fit the flow of the album. And I agree. And I think as a single, this is a fantastic single. Adam White, man, were you ripping along the Skeleton by the Screaming Females?
I was. I quite like this. I love the Screaming Females. This song was great. I am digging through a pile of 7 inches right now to figure out if this was on that rare B-side, though. So I'll be back. Hold on. This is important. We need to know.
Chris Barrett, man, are you done with the Screaming Females? Did you dig this track?
I got to be honest. I didn't really listen to this one. I'll say this, though. I'll say this about tour editions. I do find it interesting that they've sort of limited it to Australia. And I get, like, there's an incentive, you know, when you kind of tour certain parts of the world to kind of do something for, you know, that tour or for that, you know, that population. It's just, I could only imagine, though, if you want a physical copy and it somehow doesn't come back to the U.S., because this has happened with other records, that getting something from Australia could not be any more excruciating.
Yeah.
So I will say, you know, for those who are in Australia right now, ready to jam on some Screaming Females, more power. I'm sure they'll enjoy it.
Buy one in the
U.S. and it doesn't come back. You got to find some way to get it over here, and it's going to cost you a pretty penny.
Chris,
the shipping's no joke.
Chris, we're both record collectors. Do you enjoy tour editions? I love tour editions. It's so fun when you go to a show and you get like a rare edition of the record, maybe with extra tracks or maybe with just a different color, but which is, of course, is arbitrary. But still, right. Do you enjoy tour editions?
I do. I do find the extra tracks, like an extra 7-inch or something, interesting. And also, I guess, as a collector, it's fun if you get it. It's not fun if you don't.
Exactly. True.
But if it's something like, I don't know, numbering and changing a color or screening a cover, it's something that if you don't get it, it's not the end of the world, but it kind of makes it a little extra special if you get it. I mean, I have a few in my collection that are, you know, man, it would take a lot of money for me to part with. But yeah, definitely, I enjoy it. I think it's fun. And it gives you incentive to buy it from the band. You know, sometimes you get caught up in pre-orders. You really should go out and give the money directly to the band, especially if they're on tour, because they need that money to tour around. You know it's not an easy thing to do.
You know who does the coolest tour editions, and you can counter, but Ceremony does really cool tour editions. For one of their 7-inch tour editions, what they did is they took a lottery ticket and they glued it face down. They taped it face down on the record. And then on the record, they wrote, "This is... You know, you can tear the lottery ticket off to see if you won $1 million, but then you'll destroy the record. Or you can leave the lottery ticket there and not destroy the record, but you might have lost $1 million, which I think is amusing. It's I don't know, it's kind of a perhaps a little too what's the word I'm looking for? Pretentious, but maybe not, commentary on record collecting. And then for Ronette Park, they did a caricature of all the guys in the band, but it was done in an homage to a famous Metallica tour edition record. And for the last one, L-Shaped Man, this was really cool, is Ross Farrar. He's the singer of Ceremony. The L-Shaped Man's got kind of like a scribble on the cover. So for the tour editions, he did a unique scribble for each tour edition, so like a unique drawing on each one. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That last one, the unique drawing, all about that, definitely. Lottery ticket, yeah, that's a little bit, I don't know, it's like a mind game. It's almost like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, except, you know, instead of opening chocolate to get a golden ticket, you're talking about like a record, and it's like, you know, it kind of really fucks with your head. I don't know. I mean, for the most part, I'd probably just leave the lottery ticket there, but I mean, was it Massachusetts lottery? Was it, you know, no, was it another state?
California, probably.
California lottery. Oh, you know, yeah, I don't know. More than likely not. It's not worth a winning ticket. You just don't know. So they taped it to the center label or to another.
No, it's actually only on the record is unaffected, but it's on the jacket. But if you tear it off, the record is no longer mint, you see.
Got it. Yeah. I would just leave it. Yeah. I wouldn't touch it. You know,
so. Adam White, do you have this track on Delightful 7-inch?
Yeah, I do. The version of,
Skeleton.
Well, no. So the version of Rose Mountain, there was a 7-inch in the sleeve that I didn't know was there because it wasn't on the label when I bought it that it was in there. But yeah, it has Skeleton as the A side, and then it has a demo of the song Hopeless as the B side. So that's what's in there. Now, my inability to find this in a timely manner, though, brings a question to mind. And Chris, you are really the person that can answer this, given that you own 7 million records. If you acquire an LP, and inside of the LP there is a little 7-inch 45 floating around in there, and you are cataloging this, you are inserting it onto your shelving system that you have. Do you leave the 7-inch within the LP jacket as you acquired it, or do you go put it with your 7-inches?
I would leave it. It's I mean, if it's something, I guess the best example that I have, Robotic Empire did a Nevermind tribute for Record Store Day a few years ago, and they put an extra 7-inch in. There was a little pocket for it in the jacket, which is perfect, and it stays in there. I can see it being problematic if it's just like part of it, but not part of it. But yeah, like John said, leave it. Leave it because that's what it's supposed to be part of.
Oh, you see, I've been doing the opposite. If only because, like, I hate to go I would go pull out Rose Mountain to listen to, which I do a lot because it's great. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I go to take the LP out, and then this little 7-inch would just like launch itself out of the jacket because it's just kicking around. It's in its own little paper sleeve, but it's just otherwise just hanging around inside of the jacket with the rest of it. So,
all right, actually, I told the half truth. I would catalog it as one thing, but if it's not specifically part of the record, I'd probably put it with my 7-inch.
You would shelve it, catalog it elsewhere. It. Okay.
Yeah, it's shelve it elsewhere.
All right, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not me. For me, anything that comes with the record, if I buy it from the band or if I get it in the mail, anything goes right in the record sleeve and stays there. Yeah, if it's an ad, whatever. If it's a note, it goes in the sleeve and stays there.
So you would leave the mail order catalog for 2016 Don Giovanni records.
I absolutely would. I would.
Oh. All right, there you go. So
you know what I would probably leave in should I have it anywhere, and this isn't really a record comment, I guess this is more of a, I used to get these all the times with CDs, but like everyone remembers getting like the little No Idea mail order things with anything that you used to order from No Idea, or just like a little colored piece of paper like the size of like 3.5 by 5 inches kind of thing. And you know, it would have like, here's the upcoming No Idea releases, and there would be like 300 things listed on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember those fondly. Hell, before the internet was a regular part of my life, that was a big way that I found out about stuff. So
yeah, but Rose Mountain, man.
Rose Mountain is good. You should go listen to that. Man, I wish I could see the Screaming Females. I keep missing them.
They're so good, Adam. They're so good.
They keep showing up when I'm not around, and I so do like them. But you know, speaking of stuff I like, though, John, the Briefs. The Briefs are back. Apparently, I don't even know where we got this news.
I totally buried that. I didn't realize it was like their first record in like 12 years, and I was like, oh, they're coming out with some new songs. Here you go. I got this quite subversively. Is on their Facebook, they said, we're in the studio, and they did a screenshot of song titles they're working on, and so I pulled that info from the screenshot.
Everything.
We got some raw cuts of song titles. So.
But I totally buried the lead in that, like, it's important that they're actually even recording whatsoever, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is totally a huge deal that they're recording at all. So the Briefs, for the uninitiated, it's weird because like I feel that people are totally sick of me talking about the Briefs, but none of the podcast listeners are probably sick of me talking about the Briefs because we started the podcast sort of after the Briefs were finishing their career. So those two things haven't really intersected, but my God, this is one of my favorite bands. They released I think, what, 4 or 5 LPs. They had a handful of things that were released on Dirtnap at the start. Hit After Hit came out in 2000, off the charts in 2003. There was one in between there. Hit After Hit and Off the Charts, those two at the start. Sex Objects came out in 2004. That was then released on BYO. And that was a big jump as far as bands moving from one kind of label to another, because BYO Records was releasing a lot of things that you could, I guess you could call it like Epiphat style stuff at the time. Mm-hmm. And Dirtnap, which was very much doing, I want to say, like Marked Men style garage punk, into which the Briefs, you know, fit very well. They, those two streams didn't seem to cross all that much. So the Briefs taking a hop from Dirtnap over to BYO was a big deal. So anyway, Sex Objects came out in 2004. It's one of my favorite records. It was really good. Then they did one after that called Steal Your Heart in 2005. And then that was it. They had a really killer 7-inch box set that came out a few years ago. But outside of that, and a bunch of like random sort of singles collections, the Briefs haven't been super active as of late. A bunch of them, those guys have been playing in different bands. Like really the most notable one was, oh God, and I'm going to...
Cute Lepers?
Yeah, the Cute Lepers, right? But, you know, outside of the Cute Lepers stuff, you know, the Briefs haven't been super active. There have been like sporadic reunion shows here and there, but that's about it. So them getting back together and playing stuff is a huge deal, and it's exciting. And, I don't really know what to say about it, 'cause I haven't heard anything, but I'm sure it's great, 'cause this is one of my favorite bands. So the Briefs are cool. John, were you into the Briefs back in the day?
I was not into them back in the day, but I do enjoy them. I've got a number of Briefs records and a couple of Cute Lepers records. And honestly, Briefs records and Cute Lepers records sound kind of the same to me. And I mean that as a good thing. I saw the Briefs once open for the Damned in about 2010. Fantastic show. But of course, when listening to the Briefs, it's important to acknowledge, I guess, their influence from the adverts. Do you agree, Adam White?
Oh, absolutely. There's a huge amount, like the adverts, but like not as sinister. Like there's nothing as like particularly like mean as some of the stuff on, say, like Crossing the Red Sea. Mm. But there's a lot of adverts that are in there. There's a lot of Buzzcocks that are in there. But in a way, like not like faux British, I guess. Like, there's definitely kind of that snottiness that's in there, and that's really a whole part of what makes the Briefs, but they don't to me sound like they're trying to be one of these UK bands. Like they've got an amount of like kind of like Pacific Northwest garage punk that filters through them. So anyways, the Briefs are great. We don't really know anything about this or who's releasing it or whatever, but I guess we'll know now that it's on all of our radars. So I'm going to play another Brief song. I played one to start the show just because I have the power to do so. What am I playing, John? What am I playing here?
Gary Gilmore's Eyes is always a good track. Looking Through Gary Glitter's Eyes is a good track. Play whatever you want, Adam. Play whatever you want.
Yeah, what are we going to play? Play it all.
Play
yeah.
All the all right. Brief
this
songs.
This is the Briefs discography. Oh, man. Whatever. Okay. Who cares? This is what John recommended. This is Looking Through Gary Glitter's Eyes off the charts from 2003. First released on Dirtnap, later reissued on BYO Records. Check it out.
We'll be right back.
And we are back, and while we're talking about things that reference vintage English stuff, here's an interesting story. I don't know if Adam White and Chris Barrett will be in this or into this or not. I've got a very definite opinion on this. Parlophone is going to be reissuing a box set of David Bowie recordings. It's called Who Can I Be Now, 1974 to 1976. It's the sequel box set, if you will, to the first David Bowie box set, which had all his albums from his first one through, I guess it would have been Pinups, I think. Oh, no, it actually would have been Aladdin Saints. I guess Pinups is after Aladdin Saints. So it would have been all the David Bowie albums through Pinups. And so Who Can I Be Now is where David Bowie starts to leave glam rock and starts venturing into blue-eyed soul and even kraut rock. The interesting thing about this box set, it's going to be 13 discs, a lot of discs. But one of the discs will be The Gouster. The Gouster, and people say, what is The Gouster? Chris, say, what is The Gouster?
What is it?
The Gouster is the early version of Young Americans. It's what David Bowie had in mind for the Young Americans album before it morphed into the Young Americans album with Tony Visconti. So what it's actually become clear what the label's done is they've taken alternate cuts from Young Americans and some demo recordings and basically pieced back together what Tony Visconti and David Bowie imagined as the Gouster to be before it became Young Americans. So the idea – it's being advertised as a lost album, but it's not really a lost album. It's outtakes from the Young American sessions put together to approximate what David Bowie might have made the Gouster had David Bowie stopped working on Young Americans before it became Young Americans. Adam White, do you have an opinion on this?
I don't. It seems cool. It is – definitely one of these things that is, I mean, given that it's part of a big box set, is probably, unless it ends up online where you can stream it somewhere, is going to be only really accessible to diehards that go in and get the box set. But, you know, if we're talking about album outtakes, that's sort of a suitable thing. To call it a lost album is a little bit disingenuous, just in that lost album really implies that, you know, this is something no one has ever heard to the degree that, you know, that they're not outtakes, they're not alternate versions, they're not something that became another album. Like, it's truly lost. Like, to me, lost album means something a little bit more than what this is. This is definitely super interesting, but, you know, not, I wouldn't call it a lost album.
I agree. I think, this is more marketing ploy. To call, you know, and say, oh, you know, what could it be for those who maybe try to straddle the line of calling themselves a diehard, someone who just really loved him, and oh, a lost album. Yeah, let me go get this. It's more like outtakes. It's like, okay. So, you know, I kind of hate marketing that you feel like you need to use, not to get too technical with the term now, but I mean, that's what it is. You know, if it's, you know, taking in like outtakes and something else and bringing that in, you know, those who want it are going to go for it anyway. So I get, you know, but they're going to extra few people who may be on the fence to push them over with something, as Adam said, best disingenuous. Yeah. I mean, you know, it sounds cool. I'm not personally going to go get it, but you know, for those who must have it, Godspeed. It's part of the, I guess if you look at it, it goes into the bigger picture of these box sets for bands going on now where they're really taking up a lot of time at pressing plants where they are reproducing certain albums. So you have like the Beatles and mono and stereo. You can get either set now. So I guess this could go along the lines of that, but it would mean a little more to certain people though. So I would say that.
Yeah, I agree with you both. I mainly agree with both of you. And my opinion is this seems a little bit ghoulish in that David Bowie's only been dead, what, 6 months now, 7 months? And they're already like, here's a long-lost David Bowie album, but it's not a long-lost David Bowie album. David Bowie was firmly alive when he was working on this. And while he was working on it, he said, no, I don't want to call it the Gouster. I think I'll merge it into Young American, make something else out of it. And he made Young Americans. So it's a little disrespectful, I think, to David Bowie to take what he didn't see as a finished work and present it as David Bowie's finished work, because it's not. It's David Bowie working through some stuff. And plus, the tracks are from the tracks are from different sessions, so it's not like they were all recorded at the same time. So it really is advertising something that exists that doesn't even really exist. I would have been much more comfortable if they had called it the Gouster Sessions. I think it would have been much more not disingenuous, much more genuine, and they would have sold almost the same amount of copies, I think, or maybe even the same amount of copies, and you'd be like, oh, here's an interesting artifact from history, and I will see what Dave Bowie's working on just before the Young Americans period. But instead, it seems very, you know, like, oh, you know, we're making money off David Bowie's corpse by saying he's got an unreleased album, when really they could have done it with some integrity and just said these are the recordings from during the Young American session or prior to the Young American session. I'm reminded when I bought the Brian Wilson's Beach Boys Smile box set, the front of the box set said Smile. It was $25 for two CDs. And I bought it, and then I'm like, oh, man, they finally released Smile, which is, of course, the long-lost Beach Boys album. But then when I opened it up, the disc itself said Smile Sessions, and then there was like a big book inside that said that these are the tracks that our curator picked from the massive pile of Smile recordings, which is 40 hours worth of music, and he's created what he thinks is a good approximation of what Smile might have been. So it was just falsity in advertising. It wasn't the unreleased Smile album. It was the Smile Sessions curated by someone that wasn't in the band. And that's what this is. And it just, as a consumer, it makes you feel duped, and it doesn't give you a good feeling about the product, where they could quite easily make you have a good feeling about the product by saying, here's the Young American Sessions, here's the Gouster Sessions. So it's a market. And actually, well, I don't want to drag this out, but the Rolling Stones, they put out a deluxe edition of Sticky Fingers. It said alternate take of Brown Sugar, alternate take of Wild Horses, alternate take of Can't You Hear Me Knocking. I'm like, oh boy, I can't wait to hear these. I get it. I take it home. They're not alternate takes. They're demo cuts. And you know they're demo cuts because they're low fidelity and they're the band just stops halfway through because it's a demo. It's not an alternate cut. So it just makes you feel duped. And you probably would have bought it anyway if it was truth in advertising. It just makes you, you know, it makes you feel, I don't know, used as a consumer and not a fan of those kind of practices.
Could I also tie in one other thing? And I guess not so much the demo thing, but more of the fact that David Bowie recently died. I mean, to my best knowledge, now, okay, this is one of those where it's more a little more speculatory. I believe that I heard that they were going to repress certain Prince albums at very, like, literally within 2 weeks after he died. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, I gotta double check this.
You're right, because I've seen the brand new pressings just this past week.
Okay, perfect. So, literally, I don't think those things were necessary. Were they in the works before he died, or
probably not? Honestly, but I don't know.
So I can imagine. You know, it's like capitalizing and expediting something. You know, to really get in on a moment, a short attention span. It's like, oh wow, everybody's talking about Prince because he died. So let's, you know, get in and you know, make the last few bucks off of, you know, some of his music, and repackage it and, you know, offer a tribute. And, you know, now's the time, strike while the iron's hot. So, I mean, that's what the vibe I'm getting from this David Bowie thing as well.
Well, I agree. And I think Adam White's going to address somebody that really has taken care to preserve his artist's legacy. Is that not true, Adam White?
I might. That's a nice seg here. I mean, we need to throw him a little bone after you savaged him in the opening.
I don't think he's the worst guy. I think he's probably one of the most commendable punk rockers there are. But he's not a saint. He's not an infallible person. He has faults like everybody else. And his flaw is one of my particular pet peeves, which is passive aggressiveness, which is probably my biggest pet peeve. So, and also as a punk rocker, maybe it's my job, if people say somebody's infallible, maybe it's my job to take a shot at them, because that's punk rock, you know.
Sure, no one
else is. No one else is.
You know, maybe these drones that are going to take you out aren't going to be piloted by the U.S. government. They're going to be piloted by our listeners for
I thought you were going to say about our next subject. He gets his revenge on me.
Oh, holy shit. If Ian MacKay killed you with a drone, that would be an interesting – man, that I want to write that eulogy. Okay, so
where did he buy the drone? That's the real question.
He lives in Washington, D.C.
He probably just got them lying around, right? You just – go to the impound lot, pick up someone else's drone that they've abandoned. The entire Discord Records catalog, at least most of it, if not the whole thing, is on Bandcamp now. You can basically go in and stream, I'm pretty sure in its entirety, if I'm not incorrect.
Pretty much everything.
or purchase, mind you, but you can stream everything. Everything is in there. So if you want to, you know, if you want to go in there and stream the obvious stuff, you know, everything Minor Threat's ever done, everything Rites of Spring's ever done, everything Fugazi's ever done, you know, it's all in there. If you want to go listen to, you know, stuff by cool stuff by Dag Nasty, by Q and Not You, by the Evens, by, you know, any of these Government Issue, it's all there. Yeah. So it's all there. This is a huge cache of stuff that is on Bandcamp. It's quite, I want to say that at first when I heard this story, I didn't think it was a huge deal because I thought, well, you know, shit, all this stuff is on, you know, Apple Music or Spotify or whatever else. Like, you can go listen to it using any streaming service, but this is free. So, I mean, to stream at least. So that's kind of cool. Chris, well, here's the thing about you had a ton to talk about this. So I'm just going to throw it right over to you.
I'm sorry. The thing about Bandcamp streaming. So first, I do want to preface this with, I love Bandcamp. I love Bandcamp because I'm one of the kind of real stickler digital music collectors as well. Like, I'd like to have, you know, I like my physical product, the vinyl, but I, you know, like road trips, and I'm very particular about putting certain music on road trips and having all my albums on my iPod. I have the last iPod Classic, and, you know, it's loaded with just about everything that I have. So Bandcamp is good in the sense that, as you were saying, you could stream it. Artists and labels can set limits on how much you can stream it without paying for it. So most don't, but there are a few, I'm not going to go through who I've run into walls to, but there are a few that do set maybe a 10-time listening limit, and then they'll ask for you to pay in order to, you know, to listen to it as much as you want and download it, and you'll have to either find a new browser or go to another computer to continue streaming it. But once you do buy it, you could download the Bandcamp app and stream it through there. And you could download it multiple formats. You could download it as many times as you want. If you buy a vinyl from a label that uses Bandcamp, you could put in the code. And if you have an account and you have it logged under your account, it goes under like a collection. So I really love their platform. So I'm really excited that they did this. I'm a little annoyed because I bought some Discord MP3s a few months ago, and I kind of wish I waited because I'd rather be able to access it through Bandcamp. But it's good in the sense also too for people who maybe, especially this is good for older people who maybe, you know, hear me out.
Grandma, I got you the new Minor Threats evidence. Thank you, Chris.
You remember when you lost that Minor Threat CD in 1997 in that car accident? Well, I'm able to buy it for you now. So no, it's actually good in the sense of, if you, for some reason, the CD's, you know, busted or there's a reissue or, you know, I don't know, whatever happened to it, it's just easy to get now since everything's being, you're able to access everything with your computer anyway. So stoked. I love when labels finally decide to use Bandcamp. So I enjoy it, definitely. And also, too, some stuff that I was on the fence that I've been meaning to check out forever, it allows you to check it out on an easy platform. So.
Listen, I'll say something nice about Ian MacKay because I said mean things about him. Well, not mean things, but not nice things. Well, not loving things about him earlier. Ian MacKay has done a wonderful job, probably better than almost anybody, actually probably better than anybody else, of curating, maintaining, and respecting a particular scene of music. And he truly does maintain a respect for the band and you know, promote them in a way that's befitting of the bands. And, you know, some labels, they'll never put out any archival material, whatsoever. They're like, you know, archival material is, you know, pure capitalism or whatever. I do like how Discord Record does put out archival material, like the SOA demos or the billion Fugazi live shows they've put out, or the not the Minor Threat demo, the Fugazi demo and all that stuff, or the Void demo, or the album or whatever it is. And so I think Ian MacKay has done a fantastic job, an A-plus job of curating a scene, keeping it vibrant and respecting the artists and music involved.
But
no, but I just
no, but
I just wish he wouldn't talk trash on his friends. There's my butt. But
I guess the last thing I would put in for it, I guess that I spent so much time oogling over Bandcamp. What's good is that for younger people or for people who are not privy to the Discord catalog, it's an easy way to access it. And, you know, Discord's one of those really important labels. So the more that it's exposed, you know, for those who maybe haven't been exposed yet for whatever reason, definitely an opportunity to go check it out, really easy, impulse buy some stuff. You know, one of the things I mentioned, Fire K, really started to get me into, you know, some different stuff than the usual punk that I'm into. So definitely, you know, it's good for them to finally just get all that catalog out there. Excited for Discord for that.
I wanted to mention that real quickly. I don't know if Discord stuff's on Spotify because I don't have Spotify. But from a pure business standpoint, it actually might make more business sense to have it on Bandcamp and not Spotify, or Bandcamp and Spotify and have it free to stream on Bandcamp, because people will listen to stuff on Spotify, but they won't buy it, you know. So how much money do you really make on Spotify? Like nothing. However, yeah, let's say 1 out of 1,000 people buy a Fugazi album that stream it. That's probably better money than Bandcamp. So you're actually, I mean, better money than Spotify. So you're better off streaming for free on Bandcamp with the possibility that 1 out of X people might buy, rather than Spotify where you get paid penny, you know, tiny pennies,
right?
And nobody can buy it.
And the other thing is that actually, while we're still, you know, the last thing on Bandcamp, the other thing is you can add merch. So for some reason, if, you know, I haven't been to the Discord store recently. I forget if the merch section or whatever that they have, you know, other labels like Relapse and Kung Fu Records come to mind as well. They have moved a lot more of their merch section to Bandcamp. It kind of makes it easy for people to check out with shirts. And also some people want to buy shirts and digital and other things like that. So you could push more, you know, digital sales with merch as well through Bandcamp. So it offers like an array of, you know, of choices, what you will, to kind of move stuff. So it's actually really good for that as well.
But of course, Discord is famously reticent to sell merch, except for the Minor Threat shirt, which they're selling, which I'm all for Minor Threat selling t-shirts. I definitely think they should, but where are those t-shirts made? Let's close out today's story, today's podcast. I had to get in one final shot at Ian McKay. Let's talk about one final story. Early LA punkers, the Deadbeats, are releasing a new album. It's kind of unclear if this is their first album since their original single from 1978 or if their album from 1996 counts. The band is kind of saying that the album from 1996 doesn't count, so this might be truly the first Deadbeats album. It's going to have 18 tracks on it. It's out July 31st, and they're going to have a record release show in L.A. Adam White, I don't know if you're familiar with the whole Danger House scene or the Deadbeats or any of those guys.
No, not at all. I mean, I really like the song that we attached to this, but I have, you know, and actually in trying to do my research for this show, it is not immediately the most available thing online. There's several dozen bands that have been called the Deadbeats, and only in really associating them with Danger House do you find anything useful. So, you know, school me, sir.
Well, there was an early LA record label, actually probably the first LA record label, I mean LA punk record label, I'm almost sure it was the first LA punk record label, called Danger House Recordings. They only put out, like, I think 9 singles or 10 singles. They put out the first single by X. They put out the first single by the Avengers. They put out the first single by the Germs. They put out the first single and the only single by the Deadbeats. They put out the first single by Alice Bag. They put out the first single by the Eyes. They put out the first single by the Skulls. I think the Skulls. And there's a couple more. Oh, Black Randy the Metro Squad, 2 singles. And most of the Danger House bands were kind of Stooges influenced early LA punk rock, but some of them, like the Deadbeats and also Howard Worth, kind of went off on a weird newish new wave or almost Zappa direction. Oh, and Gaze the X was in the Deadbeats playing guitar. Fame producer Gaze the X, who also has the amazing album Gaze the X and the Mommy Men. So the Deadbeats, they were only around for a couple of years. They were, you know, kind of tough sounding, but kind of arty, Frank Zappa-ish. And I'm very excited for this record. Paul Rosler had a hand in recording the record. Of course, Paul Rosler of Twisted Roots, Paul Rosler of The Screamers, Paul Rosler of Nervous Gender, Paul Rosler, the brother of Kira Rosler of Black Flag and Dose. And so this is very exciting. I don't know how good it's going to be, to tell you the truth, because listen, they're not 19 anymore, you know, but it could be very cool. Only one, I'm excited for it.
Yeah, it's
bring back the Deadbeats.
Bring them back. Yeah, I'm just gonna, like, from now on, I'm just gonna go to shows and like demand that certain bands that haven't been around for 30 years. It's like, hello, we're the Screaming Females, and I'm like, bring back Black Randy and the Metro Squad, bring him back. And they're like, sir, this is the Screaming Females. So I'm like, I want Black Randy. Sorry, he's been dead since 1981.
I like that people are gonna call you sir when you're being obnoxious in public.
Excuse me, sir. So I would say if you're gonna go and do that at a show, make sure to bring a sign and put some rhinestones on it. Make it stand out, make it pop, you know.
You know, John can do that. Yeah. He's good at, you know, dazzling things up. All right, I think that's it for us this week. Do you want to play us a song before we say our goodbyes here, Chris?
Sure. I'm gonna play and actually I'm gonna play more than a song. I'm gonna do what we should have did before when the Bruce were on. And I'm going to play a medley. So it's going to be about 10 songs mashed into a 10-minute medley. So I don't know what it is, but I guarantee you'll enjoy it. Let's do it.
That was something or other, and we are finishing up for this week. If anyone wants to email us, podcast@punknews.org. If you want to complain about how John is maligning Ian MacKay, please direct your email directly to John, because that's entirely his fault. Thanks to Greg for producing. Thanks to the bands for letting us play stuff on the shows every week, and we'll see you guys next week.